Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! Today is Human Rights Day. It's also the day the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to José Ramos Horta and Bishop Bello of East Timor.
We still have this number of the military, the security forces. We have still the pressure on the population without freedom to speak, yet to have different opinion.
I lost one sister and two brothers. The sister, she was 17 when she was killed, along with 20 other kids, two Bronco aircraft, nosedive over a village, and blew up the school and the 20 kids there.
Today, a special on the Indonesian occupation and U.S. foreign policy. It's called Massacre, the story of East Timor. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Two men bound by a dream of freedom and democracy received the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize today for their resistance to Indonesia's occupation of their homeland, East Timor. Exiled activist José Ramos Horta said his prize comes with hope that Indonesia will seek a peaceful solution to the annexation. Roman Catholic Bishop Carlos Felipe Jimenez Bello accepted his award in the name of his church and his people. Indonesia has denounced Ramos Horta as a traitor and allegedly warned Bishop Bello to temper his criticism in Oslo or face possible exile or other repercussions at home. We now turn to today's special. I produced it with journalist Alan Nairn based on our three trips to occupied Timor.
I lost one sister. And two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
Two American newsmen badly beaten, Mr. Alan Nairn and Ms. Amy Goodman.
The Indonesian army converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire on the people.
Well, we pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights.
Military assistance programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable.
Massacre, the story of East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman.
Big countries with powerful military machines should not be permitted to invade, occupy, and brutalize their peaceful neighbors.
With these words, former Secretary of State James Baker explained why the United States was going to war against Iraq. Yet 16 years earlier, another big country, Indonesia, invaded a much smaller one, East Timor, with the support of the United States. What followed was one of the greatest genocides of the 20th century. It is estimated that up to one-third of the Timorese population has been killed through a policy of army massacre and enforced starvation. Many of those who are left have been imprisoned and tortured by a military armed and trained by the United States. East Timor, a quiet farming nation on a mountainous island about 300 miles north of Australia, had been a Portuguese colony until 1974, when there was a democratic revolution in Portugal and the new government decided to disband its empire. Neighboring Indonesia, a military dictatorship more than 200 times East Timor's size, began attacking Timor in an effort to prevent the island nation from completing its move toward independence. On December 7, 1975, Indonesia launched a full invasion. Timorese shortwave radio, monitored by reporters in Australia, was heard putting out desperate calls for help.
A lot of people are being killed, I repeat, indiscriminately.
More than a thousand troops have been landed.
The night before the invasion, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and President Ford were in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, toasting General Suharto, the Indonesian ruler.
Our relationship involves a common concern for the right of every nation to pursue its destiny on its own independent and sovereign course. On behalf of Mrs. Ford and myself, I raise my glass and propose a toast.
Juan Carrascalo, the brother of the former governor of East Timor and himself a political leader now in exile, was working for the Indonesians at the time.
I arrived at Jakarta 1 hour before President Ford and Henry Kissinger landed in Jakarta. And on the same night, I was informed by Colonel Sugianto, who was a top officer in the Jakarta administration, that America had given the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor.
The United States, Suharto's main backer, supplied 90% of Indonesia's arms. The story of East Timor is a story few know about, except those who have lived through it. Six foreign journalists who were there as Indonesia attacked were executed by the Indonesian military. Australian TV correspondent Greg Shackleton sent this report the night before the frontier town where he was visiting was seized by the Indonesian troops.
Why, they ask, are the Indonesians invading us? Why, they ask, are the Australians not helping us? Who, they ask, will pay for the terrible damage to our homes? My main answer was that Australia would not send forces here. That's impossible. However, I said we could ask that Australia raise this fighting at the United Nations. That was possible. At that, the second in charge rose to his feet, exclaimed, "Camarada journalist," shook my hand, the rest shook my hand, and we were applauded because we are Australians. That's all they want, for the United Nations to care about what is happening here. The emotion here last night was so strong that we, all three of us, felt we should be able to reach out into the warm night air and touch them. Greg Shackleton at an unnamed village, which we'll remember forever, in Portuguese Timor.
And it was to be a report Australians would remember. The following day, Indonesian troops moved in and executed Shackleton and his crew. Though the government of Australia ended up siding with Indonesia, the UN Security Council denounced the invasion of East Timor and passed two resolutions, like those later passed against Iraq, calling on Indonesia to withdraw its troops without delay. But United States lobbying prevented any UN action, and as Indonesia began to execute the Timorese en masse, Washington doubled its military aid.
Pela nossa libertação.
I first arrived in East Timor in the summer of 1990. Almost 16 years after the Indonesian army first came ashore, they were still occupying East Timor. I was there with journalist Alan Nairn, a correspondent for the New Yorker magazine.
Dili, the capital city, was honeycombed with army bases and torture houses. There were soldiers on the street corners, secret police watching the market stalls and the public parks. Timorese could be hauled away to the torture houses if they were found speaking to foreign tourists or listening to foreign shortwave radio. There, people would be given electroshock, beaten with iron bars, and at night, soldiers wearing hoods would roam through the neighborhoods terrorizing the Timorese.
We did not have to go far to learn the story of East Timor. When they thought the army wasn't looking, people would approach us, speaking in their native tongue, Tetum, Portuguese or English. They were anxious to somehow get word to the outside world, but begged us to keep their names secret. We have disguised their voices.
Every village, they kill 10 people, sometimes 11, 12, they kill the people every day. My brother killed by the army. I saw them and myself. They killed in front of many people, and the army, they forbade all the people, don't cry. Brothers or sisters killed, but nobody cry. If cries, they shoot.
Traveling in the countryside, we heard of how the army had driven people off their farms. As the Timorese fled, the army bombed and strafed them from low-flying Bronco planes and other aircraft provided to Indonesia by the Ford and Carter administrations.
When the dog went,
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them. Some were still alive. We just had to keep running.
The Timorese were herded into prison and resettlement camps. In one rural village teeming with camouflaged troops, an older man told quietly of how the army had withheld food and how hunger still ravages the young.
Lack of nutrition for the children, all these consequences of children growing up not too normal in their intellectual capacity. So many people have been killed because they will be looking for food, so they have to get out of their village and are just killed outright.
When we met with the Army Intelligence Chief, Colonel Gatot Purwanto, he confirmed that the Army had killed 200,000 East Timorese and that there was widespread hunger among the survivors. Journalist Alan Nairn and I returned to East Timor in order to be present for a historic event. A special delegation from the United Nations and Portugal was due to visit East Timor. The Timorese hoped the visit would finally lead to UN action and enforcement of the Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to withdraw from East Timor.
We were told in place after place that the army had been holding neighborhood and village meetings to warn the Timorese that if they tried to speak to the UN Portuguese delegation, they and their families would be killed. And Bishop Bello, the Bishop of East Timor, told us that the threat was, "We will kill your family to the seventh generation."
But despite the threats and a dramatic increase in disappearances, torture, and deaths, Timorese had prepared to speak out. They had met in secret, making banners and petitions for the delegation. When the army tried to hunt them down, many had gone into hiding and sought refuge inside churches. But under pressure from the United States, the visit of the delegation had been called off. 3 days later, with the world spotlight removed, the army stormed the Motayal, Dili's main Catholic church, and killed a young man named Sebastio Gomez, who had taken refuge there. And then came the morning of November 12, the two-week commemoration of Sebastio's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastio's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come, came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd, between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we, as foreign journalists, could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
Soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. The Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood. And the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in, one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis of fear. They were not able to move, some of them, at least in the cemetery, and indeed even in the trucks when I saw them going by, were barely breathing. And people are that terrified, it's quite often difficult to tell if they're dead or alive.
After 9 hours in custody, Stahl went back to the cemetery under cover of night, dug up his video cassettes, and had them smuggled out of the country. Alan Nairn and I had managed to leave East Timor a few hours after the massacre. From a hospital on Guam, we reported what had happened to dozens of newspapers, radio, and television outlets around the world.
From Washington, this is the Pacifica Report for Tuesday, November 12, 1991. A massacre in East Timor. Among those injured were two journalists, including the news editor of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people, and these were truly...
Nippon Sefu wa Indonesia ni shinsou kyumei wo moshiru.
Kokkai Timor, when Indonesian troops opened fire on a crowd...
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military...
Imagens do primeiro...
Photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom.
Is the CBS Evening News.
In the face of the massacre...
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us. Love from us.
You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
No blackout dark. No business deal big enough. No heart hollow. No grave. wide.
You're listening to Democracy Now! As we go back to Massacre, the story of East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman.
In the face of the massacre story, even Suharto's longtime allies were compelled to condemn the killings and came under public pressure to cut back their aid to Indonesia. In Australia, large crowds marched on the capital and surrounded Indonesia's local consulates. The European Parliament voted for sanctions against Indonesia, and the European Community later cancelled the scheduled trade pact. There were even open protests inside Indonesia, where student demonstrators were beaten and arrested. Back in the United States, the Bush administration continued to ship weapons to Indonesia.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The only time President Bush mentioned East Timor publicly was months after the massacre, when asked about it by a Portuguese journalist.
A lot of discussion is going on the tragedy in East Timor. We have expressed ourselves in terms of the pure human rights part of it. We pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights. And I think we've made clear to the parties that are interested there the U.S. position. I don't know
that position to call for an increase in U.S. military training aid. It's called IMET, International Military Education and Training. State Department spokesperson Richard Boucher.
I think that a continued and well-focused military assistance program for Indonesia can contribute to the professionalization of the Indonesian military. And these kind of programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
More than 2,600 Indonesian officers have been trained under IMET since 1975. They include those who planned the invasion and have overseen the policy of mass slaughter. Immediately after the massacre, General Tri Sutrisno, the national commander of the Indonesian Armed Forces, gave a speech to a military gathering. He said of the Timorese who dared to oppose the Indonesian Armed Forces, "They must be shot," adding, "and we will shoot them." Meanwhile, a movement to change U.S. policy towards Indonesia was growing in the U.S. Congress. After the massacre, 52 senators sent a letter to President Bush supporting self-determination for East Timor. And in the House, members began working to cut off the IMET training aid. But the U.S. State Department remained firmly on Suharto's side. I questioned Larry Dinger of the State Department's Indonesia desk during a public forum.
A third of the population has been killed, about 200,000 people. More than 100 people with U.S. weapons were killed on November 12th. What would it take for the State Department to say we should cut off aid?
What does it take to cut off aid? As I understand it, American law says that if a nation is classified as a gross violator of human rights, then aid should be restricted to basic human needs deliverance. The State Department, including the Human Rights Bureau of the State Department, does not consider that Indonesia qualifies for that classification. It has never considered that, and it doesn't today.
After the massacre, repression got worse in East Timor. The Timorese bishop, Carlos Jimenez Bello, this year's Nobel Peace Prize co-winner, revealed that many of the wounded were executed in their hospital beds. Hundreds were beaten, shot, and stabbed, and finished off with lethal injections. A dozen massacre survivors were jailed, getting sentences up to life for organizing the procession or expressing enmity toward Indonesia. As this was going on, the United States was secretly commiserating with Suharto's generals and helping them evolve a strategy of damage control. Internal State Department documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act show that on December 10, 1991, 5 years ago today, less than a month after the massacre, U.S. officials told a meeting of Indonesian generals and admirals that while Washington, quote, understands Indonesia is under considerable pressure from the world at large, we do not believe that friends should abandon friends in times of adversity. The documents show that in another meeting, 2 weeks later, Suharto's senior advisor, Dr. Widjojo, thanked the U.S. for its support in the massacre's wake, and contrasted that stand with that of other nations that had threatened to cut off aid. Indonesia tried to fend off aid cuts by transferring out two generals and court-martialing low-level soldiers, ostensibly for disobeying orders during the massacre. But one of the generals, purportedly being disciplined, was sent to the United States, with Indonesia announcing that he would study business at Harvard. While in Massachusetts, the general, Sintang Panjaitan, was sued by the family of a massacre victim, Kamal Bamadhaj, a New Zealand citizen. Panjaitan was found guilty by default in a U.S. federal court and was ordered to pay $14 million in damages. He declared the verdict a joke and fled back to Indonesia. Panjaitan's successor, General Mantiri, the regional commander for East Timor, announced the massacre had been proper because the Timorese had been demonstrating against the state. Abilio Osorio, the Indonesian-appointed governor of East Timor, then said that the army should have killed more Timorese on November 12th. In the wake of such statements from senior Indonesian officials that it is policy to kill dissident Timorese, critics in the U.S. Congress, like Democratic Representative Tony Hall of Ohio, were unimpressed by Jakarta's moves.
Under Indonesian rule, there is no justice for East Timor. I see no reason why we should reward Indonesia's armed forces with more military aid.
In October 1992, almost a year after the massacre, Congress voted to cut off IMET aid, a move spearheaded by the House.
Those in favor, let it be known by saying aye. Those opposed, no. In opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
The vote came in the face of an intensive lobbying campaign to keep the aid, mounted by the Suharto government, the U.S. State Department, Pentagon, and U.S. multinational companies like General Electric and AT&T. Those lobbying to cut the aid included human rights, peace, and church groups, and a new national grassroots movement in support of East Timor. Congressmember Tony Hall and Rhode Island Republican Ron Makeley led the fight against the aid in the House.
Here, in East Timor, we have the power to bring about a change.
Although the IMET cutoff marked a breakthrough in U.S. policy, to this day Washington continues to arm the Suharto regime. But there is now a growing movement in Congress to stop further U.S. weapon sales and to pressure the new Clinton administration to dramatically change the course of U.S. policy. Much of the congressional action has been in direct response to the growth in the U.S. of grassroots Timor activism. Charlie Shiner is coordinator of the East Timor Action Network.
After the Santa Cruz massacre in November 1991, it seemed like there was an opportunity to maybe change not only U.S. policy toward Indonesia and East Timor, but to change the Indonesian policy and get the Indonesian military out of East Timor, because there was a lot more public awareness and attention being paid to it than had been paid for about 15 years. So I and some other people formed this grassroots organization in the U.S., the East Timor Action Network, as a way for people who felt the same way we did to put their awareness, put their energy into some kind of pressure on the U.S. government and on the Indonesian government.
In the fall of 1992, activists made East Timor an issue in the Wisconsin senatorial campaign between Bob Kasten, the Republican incumbent, and Russell Feingold, his Democratic challenger.
My opponent, whom I defeated, Senator Kasten, was the leading proponent of providing the arms and continuing American military aid to Indonesia last year, and another Wisconsin congressman, Congressman Obie, led the fight to stop that aid. So I became aware of it during the campaign and was contacted by a number of people back in Wisconsin who continue to contact me about the human rights violations. So it came from Wisconsin, but now it's become very relevant to what I do as a member of the Foreign Relations Committee.
Once in the Senate, Feingold became a leader on Timor policy.
My feeling is that this is just the tip of the iceberg of places where in the past American foreign policy has done just the opposite of what American values would dictate. And it makes me want to get in there and root out this, what I consider to be borderline corruption of our foreign policy, and to find it in the East Timor situation and find it in other places so that the United States, people of the United States are not paying for this kind of thing.
Senator Feingold's talk of corruption proved to be unwittingly prophetic. For this past October, after 21 years of being largely ignored by the corporate press, the issues of East Timor and Indonesia suddenly burst on the national scene. Today, the Nobel Peace Prize winners, Bishop Bello and José Ramos Horta, are receiving their awards in Oslo, Norway. When the Nobel Prizes were announced in October, a national campaign scandal broke over contributions to the Democrats by the Riadis, an Indonesian business family closely aligned with Suharto. In a scandal that's still unfolding, it's now known that the Riadis and their associates gave more than $1 million to the Democrats, and apparently in return were treated to dozens of White House meetings, at one point helping to broker a sit-down meeting between Suharto and President Clinton. But though James Riadi, the Indonesian billionaire, had direct access to the Oval Office, Clinton has so far refused to meet with José Ramos Horta. I questioned White House press spokesperson Mike McCurry about this.
Yeah.
James Riadi visited the White House dozens of times over the years of the Clinton administration, talking on many occasions about policy.
I never said on many occasions that they talk policy.
Talking about policy sometimes.
If you know that to be true, I don't know that to be true.
By your own admission, James Riotti has come to the White House.
And by the president's own admission, Friday, he knows James Riotti and has known him for a long time and has seen him on a number of occasions.
Yet you say, when it comes to the Nobel Peace Prize winners from East Timor, that there are no plans for them to meet with President Clinton. Is it because they haven't made a campaign contribution, or that those who have don't want them here?
They've been. Bishop Bello has been here at the White House. Met with Tony Lake several times. Has he got any plans to be here anytime soon?
José Ramos-Horta is here in Washington this
week. Does Bishop Bello have any plans to be here? That's what I asked.
What about José Ramos-Horta, the other?
I am not aware
Peace
of any
Prize
plans
winner
for the president to see him. Yes.
Why not?
He's
just won the Nobel Peace Prize.
The president's got a big schedule, and that's not one of the items that's on the schedule.
When José Ramos-Horta was in town just a few weeks ago, I asked him about the Riotti scandal and about any invitations to the White House.
I find it just extraordinary that an Indonesian businessman should be discussing with President Clinton the situation in East Timor. What the hell that thug Riotti, you know, close to the regime, has to do with discussing American politics towards East Timor? It is just beyond my comprehension. The Indonesian businessmen, they're all very well connected with the military. Somehow, directly or indirectly, they are also responsible for the crimes of the regime in Indonesia and in East Timor. So I find it just bewildering that President Clinton should even allow him, this so-called Riotti, to talk police policy matters in terms of foreign policy, in terms of human rights. Because certainly Riotti was not briefing the president about the human rights situation in Indonesia and East Timor. He probably was urging the president to stop raising human rights concerns regarding East Timor.
He has been invited to the White House. He has been to the White House dozens of times over the last few years. Have you gotten an invitation as the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize winner to meet with President Clinton?
No, I have not received an invitation. I hope that sometime in the near future we will be able to meet with President Clinton. I do not want the same honor of Mr. Riotti. You know, I don't want to compare myself with Mr. Riotti. I'm a poor person. The money that I get from the Nobel Peace Prize, I could not contribute also to the National Democratic Committee. If I could, if I had more extra money, I might do that. But unfortunately, I have to apologize. We are too poor to contribute to anyone, and the money is going to a foundation on called Peace and Democracy, Don Martinho da Costa Lopes. That's the former bishop of East Timor, to honor his memory and to do something, you know, that he always wanted to do, and that is to support the struggle for self-determination, to support humanitarian efforts of our people, to give a scholarship to Timorese who lost their scholarship in Indonesia, to East Timorese prisoners, their families, orphans, and so on. The foundation will be set up in Portugal. All the money that is my share will go to that foundation. So I'm sorry, you know, I feel embarrassed to be poor, because if I were rich or a bit like Mr. Riotti, maybe I could help also the National Democratic Committee.
Indogate has generated a great deal of partisan heat, with Republicans promising hearings and even talk of impeachment in the air. Recently, on the Sunday morning talk show this week, Sam Donaldson questioned Republican Senator John McCain and Democrat Bill Bradley. This is McCain.
There is no doubt that there was a 180-degree shift in United States policy towards Indonesia from candidate Clinton in 1992 to President Clinton in 1996. I mean, that's a fact. The question is what caused that change in American policy towards Indonesia, for which two individuals just got the Nobel Peace Prize in their struggle for human rights there.
Senator Bradley, are we chasing a partisan will-o'-the-wisp here, or is there something down the road that is labeled impeachable offense?
Well, So far, the debate has focused on narrow, traditional Washington questions: campaign corruption, bribery, and lying to the press. But the deeper issue of the U.S. policy of propping up regimes like Suharto's has yet to be raised by most politicians or the corporate press. This fall, as the scandal broke, the East Timor Action Network organized a Washington press conference which featured Constancio Pinto, the former leader of the Timorese civilian underground now exiled in the United States. Pinto organized the cemetery procession that the Army massacred in 1991 and has just written a memoir of his life and the resistance. The book is called East Timor's Unfinished Struggle, and it's published by South End Press. Pinto recalls his experiences as a youth fleeing from the 1975 Indonesian invasion of his country and then under attack from U.S.-supplied planes, being placed in a concentration camp.
Many people die. As my own experience, I saw at least 15 people die every day. They die of starvation and diseases. And besides of that, there were also persecution, arbitrary execution, rape, and torture.
Pinto said it was a shock to learn that a country he admired was arming and backing the invaders who were killing off his people.
I joined my part, and we went into the jungle, where we spent 3 years in the jungle. For 3 years, we were persecuted every day. Sometimes every day, I'd say, by the Indonesian military. We were bombed by OV-10 fighters, American tanks and ships, and AR-15 rifles. I didn't know that all of those military equipments were belonged to the United States. I came to understand when the guerrilla fighters capture some of those weapons from Indonesia, and it says very clearly, made in the United States, made in U.S. And it was a surprise to us to see the United States as a democratic country which stands on human rights, supporting Indonesia to conduct the genocide in East Timor.
Pinto says the real scandal that Americans should focus on now is the fact that the U.S. still continues to arm Suharto's troops and to prevent the U.N. from organizing a free referendum in East Timor. His comments echoed what Bishop Bello had told Alan Nairn and me in November of 1994 when we returned to East Timor for the first time since the massacre. After the massacre, Suharto's government had banned us as, quote, threats to national security, but they announced that we could return to Indonesia for the occasion of the APEC summit. When we took them up on the offer and then tried to enter East Timor, we were arrested twice by Indonesian military intelligence. The first arrest took place on the anniversary of the massacre, at the same moment that, in East Timor, uprisings were breaking out in the streets, and at the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, a group of young Timorese had courageously scaled the compound's fence and staged a dramatic protest sit-in. When, on the third try, we succeeded in entering East Timor without the Army's knowledge, we found checkpoints everywhere and an atmosphere of intensified terror. When one night we showed up unannounced at Bishop Bello's residence, he said the terror was worse than it had been since 1983.
We still have this number of the military, the security forces. We have still the pressure on the population without freedom to speak, yet to have different opinion. And then the security forces are everywhere.
Bishop Bello repeated his call, first made in 1989, for a UN-supervised referendum under which the Timorese would freely determine their future political status. But Bello stressed that the United States and President Clinton held the key. He recalled the U.S.'s historic role.
Important to also to pay attention for the East Timor people. And President Clinton should be more stronger in his statements. If in 1975 President Ford gave order to Indonesian troops to enter East Timor, I think that now it is the right time for President Clinton to say the Indonesian withdraw for East Timor.
During a news conference Clinton held when he was running for president in 1992, I asked him about his stance on East Timor.
I think it's something we have to look very carefully at. I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor, and I think we have to review it. I'm not prepared at the present time to say categorically we should cut off all aid. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable. I think we have to engage the government on the question of how those people are being treated, and I certainly wouldn't rule out the prospect of cutting aid.
This was the first and only time in the campaign that Clinton mentioned Timor. Today, some in Washington are trying to claim that Clinton started out tough on Suharto, but then, as the Riotti money came in, reversed course and turned pro-Jakarta. In fact, Clinton was never tough on Suharto. His policy has been a continuation of Washington's long-standing and bipartisan support for the regime. You're listening to Democracy Now!, our special Massacre, the Story of East Timor. We'll be back in 60 seconds.